All right, well, that's the title of my talk. I have to remember to hit this green button every time. So I'm going to just try this now and go right. It'll work. So this talk is about large deviations for zeros of random holomorphic sections. I don't think it's going to be a familiar problem to anybody. So I designed the talk to not to have too many details in it, but to just try to explain what the problem is. So we want to understand, well, large deviations for probabilities of zero of configurations of zeros, random holomorphic sections, and the main result, roughly speaking, will say that the zero configurations of random holomorphic sections concentrate at the equilibrium measure exponentially fast. So the key object describing the configuration of zeros is what is known in probability as the empirical measure of zeros. It's a bit of a strange term, but it's universal in the subject. So we're fixing an ample line bundle of degree n. We're only studying compact Riemann surfaces. I do not know how to generalize any of the results I'm going to mention to higher dimensional manifolds. I should have said from the start that this is a work in progress that should be almost finished, but is not exactly finished, so there's always some uncertainty about the exact match of hypotheses and results, but I think I'm stating it all correctly. And it's based on joint work with Schiffman and with Ofer Zeitouni. Okay, so the empirical measure of zeros is just the obvious measure. We just put delta functions at the zeros and divide by the number, and we obtain a probability measure. Now, there's really a second way of describing the configuration of zeros, and to a large extent, the first thing I want to explain is how these two points of view fit together. So the second way you can think about a configuration of zeros is as a point in configuration space. You just look at the set of zeros. I write it as a divisor. And it's a point in configuration space. So in a way, we have these two different ways of describing the zeros of a polynomial or a section of a line bundle over Riemann surface. We can either view it as a point in configuration space, or we can view it as a probability measure. And they're very closely related because, well, one is a subset of the other. If we have a point in the configuration space, then we can just map it into the space of probability measures by summing the delta functions at the point in the configuration space. So the first idea is that we're going to be trying to take the limit as n tends to infinity, as the degree tends to infinity. And unlike some of the previous things like correlation functions, where it's a function of maybe two or three points on the Riemann surface, here we're going to be looking at functions of capital N points on the Riemann surface. So we're going to be looking at functions and measures on the configuration space. And our problem is, how do we take the limit as n tends to infinity when the space itself is changing? Right? So following a tried and tested practice in large deviations, we're just going to map the configuration spaces all into one fixed space, the space of probability measures on the Riemann surface. Okay? And then all of the configuration spaces embed into the space of measures. And then we're going to be able to take large n limits of functionals of configurations. Now, we're interested in the question, how probable is a given configuration of zeros? Well, in order to define that, we have to introduce a probability measure on the space of sections. Actually, for the purposes of what I'm doing today, there's a wide variety of probability measures that you can put on it. I'm only going to be talking about what are called Gaussian probability measures, but actually, for really, I think, the first problem that we studied in the probability, you could introduce much more general nonlinear measures. In fact, I'll try to explain what they are later, but let's see, how does this thing work? Red thing? Yeah. All right, so for most of this talk, I'm only going to be talking about CP1 because the measures that you introduce there are much simpler than they are in higher genus. But even on CP1, we can introduce many different measures. So I say that the simplest and most natural are Gaussian measures, and the Gaussian measures are going to depend on a choice of two objects from the beginning. One is a smooth Hermitian metric on the line bundle. It's not assumed to have a positive curvature 1-1 form. It's just any smooth metric. And the second will be a probability measure on the curve C, on the Riemann surface C. So I should have said CP1 because that's what we're doing. So Gaussian measures are measures which are determined by inner products on the space of sections. So given this data, for any n, so here I'm specifying to genus 0, but this would have worked in any genus. We specify the inner product by saying that the L2 norm squared with respect to this L2 norm, this Hermitian metric, is the integral of the pointwise Hermitian norm with respect to h to the n, and then integrated against this measure. I'm going to be talking about so many measures in this talk that this one here is kind of fixed from the start and will be the same throughout the entire talk. So I might just say that, you know, in background that when Schiffman and I started working in this area, we always assumed that H was a positively curved metric and that nu was a smooth measure that was induced by the metric, taking its curvature 1-1 form and making a volume form out of it. And then Bloom sort of, started making very much more general kind of choices of this measure, Bernstein-Markov measure, which we're going to do. Now it's sort of standard now to do that. And Berman also started looking at more general smooth measures. So this is a very general kind of inner product, and we're going to, we want this level of generality. We want as few assumptions on nu and on h as we can get away with. So the Gaussian measure is given by this formula. So this is perfectly meaningful. DS means a choice of Lebesgue measure on the Hilbert, on this Hilbert space. And then we take e to the minus L2 norm squared of the section. So this is just a Gaussian measure on a finite dimensional vector space. At this point, I might mention that instead of taking S squared, the kind of methods we're using could be taking any LP norm to the pth power, for example, or any kind of potential of S. It's very, very general. It doesn't really matter for what I'm doing. So just to explain this formula more concretely, what one does is to pick an orthonormal basis with respect to this inner product and then just write every section as a linear combination of the orthonormal basis. And we write that in coordinates, the normalized Gaussian measure. That's what I mean more specifically by that. So what this means is that these coefficients are random variables. They are independent, complex, normal, random variables. So they have expected value 0, which I think almost everybody here realizes means that if you integrate CJ against this measure, you get 0. And if you do CJ CK, you get 0. But if you do CJ CK bar, you get the delta function. So just a word about why Gaussian measure. So the reason why we choose a Gaussian measure is that In general, the kind of problems you're interested in for random polynomials or sections is to make a probability measure depending only on the coefficients of the section. It's written nicely in terms of the coefficients. And then you want to study the map from coefficients to zeros, which is a very complicated map. There's nothing stopping you from putting the probability measure directly on the zeros of the polynomial, but that, in a sense, would be defeating the purpose, which is to study things about zeros given information about the coefficients. So Gaussian measure is simpler than just picking a section at random from the unit sphere. I could have just put a delta function on the sphere where the sum of the mod CK squareds is equal to 1. I could have just picked at random a section from L2 norm equals 1. That is considered an equivalent ensemble. Gaussian measures are somewhat simpler analytically. They are completely equivalent. So if you're not familiar with Gaussian measures, you can just think that I'm picking a section at random from the unit sphere in Hilbert space. In higher genus, the ensemble we need is going to be more complicated. It involves Abel-Jacobi theory, so I postpone it for a while. That's why I'm going to start with genus zero. And as I mentioned, instead of just picking something at random from the unit sphere, we could have weighted it by, for example, e to the minus its LP norm to the P power for some P, or many, many other choices like that, if we want to get more general types of problems. Now, if we stick with Gaussian measures, as I just said, it's equivalent to use the spherical measure. It's also equivalent to use a Fubini-Studi measure on the projective space of sections. And that's the most elegant way of doing it. Namely, since the zeros of a section and any multiple of the section are the same, it's better to look at just lines of sections. And then we're just on the projective space of section. And the Fubini and the inner product induces a Fubini-Studi metric and volume form on this projective space, which is essentially the same as choosing the section at random from the unit sphere, but takes into account that the zeros will be the same for any constant multiple. So I guess I'll use this notation again, that this will be a Fubini-Studi volume measure on projective space. I'll write down the formula in a second. So this is a special choice of a section of a polynomial given a set of zeros. Oh, yeah, I want to explain this Fubini-Studi measure. Well, I still haven't written it down. I should have written it on the next slide. But anyway, we can reinterpret this Fubini-Studi volume form in another way. Namely, over the configuration space of n points, here we have a section. We have a line bundle over the configuration space of n points whose fiber is the line of holomorphic sections with zeros at that point. Okay? We have a line bundle over the configuration space, and the line at a configuration is the line of holomorphic sections or polynomials here with these zeros. So in other words, it's the constant multiples of this polynomial. And you can see this polynomial is a section of this line bundle. So if I can define a Hermitian metric on this line bundle, I have to give you the Hermitian norm of a point in the line at every point. So here's what a point looks like at zeta 1 through zeta n. And it's a function. So the norm of it is just its L2 norm, using this Hermitian inner product. Okay? This is just it's another way of explaining what's going on with this Fubini-Studi measure, which I think is easier, well, nice to think about. Okay? So the explicit formula for the Fubini-Studi measure, given an inner product, is to take dd bar log of the norm squared of a point. In this formula, via some vector space of functions. So f is a point in this vector space, and when I'm taking dd bar, I'm taking it in the f variable. Or if you like, you can write out f as a sum cj fj, and then you're taking it in the c variables. So this is not the formula where f is a function of z. I'm not taking dd bar in the z variable. I'm taking it in the variable f. And then we have the standard formula for the Fubini-Studi volume form on this thing over here, on the line bundle ON over here, which can be viewed as this line bundle over here. So this F squared is just a Hermitian metric on the line here. Now, in a certain sense, I've already done what I'm saying I'm going to do here. The first important object I'm going to introduce is called the joint probability currents of zeros. It's an object which has never been studied before in this probabilistic theory of sections. People have studied correlation functions and other things, but the joint probability current of zeros is sort of like the endpoint correlation function for polynomials of degree n. We have an original Gaussian measure, alias Fubini-Studi measure, on this projective space, a volume form on this projective space. But we have a divisor map mapping the sections here to the zeros. So we can push forward the Fubini-Studi volume form on this space to the configuration space. In other words, what I'm really trying to do is just take this volume form over here and rewrite it in zeros coordinates. Usually when you write down a formula for the Fubini-Studi measure, it would be, you would choose the basis of V, identify F with A1 through AN, and then this would be the usual coordinate formula. But I wrote it in an invariant form because what I really want to do is write it in terms of zeros coordinates. If you think it's obvious, try to imagine doing this in higher dimensions. So this is an example. We want to change variables from coefficients to zeros. And we're just going to end up with the curvature form of that line bundle over configuration space and its volume form. So here is the formula for the joint probability current of zeros. Namely, it's a current on the configuration space. So we have n variables on configuration space. These should be the zeros. And by definition, we take the expected value of the empirical measure as a function of zeta 1, tensor itself. That's the formal definition. And it's the probability density. It's a current. So as a coefficient of the Lebesgue measure in a chart, this is an invariant formula that does not involve choosing coordinates. But roughly speaking, this is the probability density of finding a section with zeros at these points. Right, so this is the object we're interested in. When I say how likely is a configuration of zeros, I mean how do we evaluate this joint probability current of zeros? That's the key object, right? That's the, so to speak, the probability density of a polynomial having zeros at these points. Now, an explicit calculation, which I'm just going to write down, is that here is the formula. So it's really taking the previous formula. Well, I don't dare to go backwards, but it's the volume form for the Fubini-Studi measure just written out. You remember that in the numerator, you just have dw1 through dwn in coefficients, and you change variables from coefficients to zeros, and the Jacobian of the change of variables from coefficients to zeros is the van der Waals determinant. That numerator is very, very easy to understand in genus zero. It's more problematic in higher genus. That is, when you change from coefficients to zeros, what's the analog of the van der Waals in higher genus? That's why I'm starting with genus zero. And then in the denominator, you might remember you have the L2 norm squared of the section to the power n plus 1. The product z minus zeta j was a section of that bundle over configuration space. And so here is its L2 norm to the power n plus 1. So this is just writing in the formula for the Fubini-Studi volume form. Okay, so this is a simple formula to derive in genus zero. Yes? Yeah, that's a good question. It's completely different, actually. In fact, I had a whole section taking the way we wrote it down, two or three different ways we had of writing down the correlation functions. The correlation functions are obtained by integrating out all but, let's say, two variables or three variables here. Yes, the way we did it would have been a formula for the endpoint correlation function and is entirely different. And in fact, I was never able to prove these results using that formula. It's a good question because that formula makes sense in all dimensions. If one could figure out how to use that formula for the purposes here, one would be able to generalize these results to higher dimensions. Now, so this formula is basically, by the way, you know, the formula that goes from zero to coefficients is just the Newton formula. You know, the zeta j's go to the product of z minus zeta j. And we just take, it's just based on that. Zn, by the way, is a normalizing constant here, which is a very interesting constant. As we'll see later on, it's related to volumes of balls in spaces of sections. But actually, at this point, I just quoted a result of Berman and Buxom in calculating this thing. But they're rather interesting. This is, by the way, if you're not interested in probability theory, this is the curvature volume form of that line bundle over configuration space, which would be an interesting object to consider aside from probability theory. So now, the purpose is that we want to take the large n limit of this formula. Now before, with Schiffman, Blecher, we integrated out all but two variables. That would be correlation functions, or all but three or four variables. In general, you get the k-point correlation function by integrating out all but k variables. And then we took large n limits in various ways. But here I'm leaving all n variables in, and I want to still take the large n limit. Okay, that's what makes this problem new. Now, how can you take the large n limit when it's a function on a space that keeps changing with n? Well, this problem has occurred many, many times in probability and statistical mechanics. And there's a kind of a standard answer which was used in random matrices. In fact, this project was motivated by similar results on eigenvalues of random matrices due to Benaruz-Itouni and Benaruz-Guionet. But it is a standard thing in physics, actually, too. The way you deal with the space, which with functions on a space, which keeps changing with n, is to map the problem, map the configuration spaces to the space of measures. So I mentioned it before, but it's a really important point. So it seems very strange because configuration spaces are beautiful geometric objects. The space of measures on CP1 is kind of a ugly looking thing. It's a metric space under the Wasserstein metric, but it has a topology of weak convergence. But we're losing the geometry in a sense when we map to the space of measures. Okay? But that's the idea, so we map by using the empirical measure of zeros. Now here's the thing, I think, which is going to be the most curious thought if you haven't encountered it before. We have a measure on configurations on this configuration space, the Fubini-Studi volume form that I just wrote down, the Vandermonde formula. Now I have a map to the space of probability measures. So I'm going to push forward the measure on configuration space to get a measure, a probability measure, on the space of probability measures. It sounds rather peculiar the first time you hear it, but it's a standard thing in large deviation. In the book of Ellis on large deviations and statistical mechanics, this... don't ask me what a Polish space is. It's a metric space. Maybe I must admit the word Polish is not in my vocabulary. Maybe it should be. I've heard of it before, but I don't know. Anyway, we're going to push forward the measure from here to here. So this is called level 3 large deviations in the theory of large deviations. We're going to study a family of probability measures on the space of probability measures. It has many, many applications, this idea. Once you hear of it, you'll realize how many people have been doing this in one form or another. It's what physicists are always doing when they write down functional integrals. They write it down over some unspecified space of fields, and had they taken the time to specify it, it would have been a space of probability measures or a space of distributions. So our main result is the following. So our main result is a large deviations estimate for this family of probability measures. Now, I will define it in a moment, but whenever you have a sequence of probability measures on a fixed space, you can ask, does it satisfy a large deviations principle? And a large deviations principle means there is a speed, n squared, and there is a rate functional, I. And this is essentially what it means. This is a sort of a schematic way of writing it down. You take 1 over n squared of the log of the probability that a measure belongs in the set, some Borel set of measures, E. So when I said we were going to try to do the large and asymptotics of these measures, you can only do this in a very weak sense. You only take logarithms of probabilities and divide by n squared. Okay? The rate functional, so the speed is what you divide the logarithm by, and the rate functional is given over here. So I hope my next slide will give a little bit more on this. I guess not. I'll just state the result first, then I'll come back. But, you know, roughly speaking, it means that the probability, of a set E roughly looks like the integral over E of e to the minus n squared I of mu in a sort of schematic way. It roughly speaking means that, you know, the probability has a formula like this where you sort of integrate over the set E, e to the minus n squared times the rate functional, roughly speaking. Of course, there's no genuine formula like this. It's just a heuristic idea. So here is the result. So there's a technical assumption on nu. Well, there are two technical assumptions on nu. One is the Bernstein-Markov property, and the other is something to do with the Green's function. And then with those two technical assumptions, this sequence of probability measures on the space of measures satisfies a large deviations principle with speed n squared, and here is the rate functional. So I'm going to skip these two terms. I'm writing my Hermitian metric as e to the minus phi. So this is just to do with the choice of the Hermitian metric. The interesting part, and this is just some constant depending on the metric also, it's the functional of the measure. So it looks like minus 1/2 of the energy. For me, the energy is negative. The Green's function is negative at the singularity, so this is the positive version of the energy. A lot of people just define the energy with a minus sign here. So this is the one where, in general, this one has a minimizer. In general, these large deviation functionals are lower semi-continuous, so this one has a minimizer. And here you have a rather strange second term. So the original smooth metric H defines the Green's function, and the energy means the energy of the measure with respect to the Green's function. And then this U is the potential, the Green's potential, with respect to that Green's function. And we take its supremum over K, where K is the support of the of nu. I guess I didn't put that in. K here is the support of this measure nu. The only way that nu ends up in the final formula is through through its support here, through this support. So we'll see, as we're seeing it, it's a rather unusual formula, I think. Rather unusual functionals. I've looked around in the subharmonic literature. I haven't really seen this one studied. Maybe some experts in the audience will have noticed, have seen this functional. Anyway, we have this functional. Now, the second part is that this rate functional is proper, it's lower semi-continuous, and there's a unique measure that minimizes it. And that's the equilibrium measure of K with respect to H. Now, normally the equilibrium measure would be the minimizer of this energy. If you restrict it to measures supported on supported on K. But strangely, these measures here are not assumed to be supported on K. So it's not obvious that that there's a unique minimizer of this functional and that it is the equilibrium measure for K with respect to the metric H. So what does the large deviations result mean intuitively? Well, first of all, because this measure here, this I function, if you remember this sort of formula here, the probability of the probability of a measure mu or of a set of measures is like the integral of e to the minus n squared I. So this the probability of damping out exponentially rapidly with rate and exponent given by this rate, it's exponentially damping out configurations of zeros which are not close to the equilibrium measure. So here, by the way, I just wrote down the definition of the Green's function. For any metric H, it's the relative potential for the curvature 1-1 form of H minus the delta function at Z. By GDC lemma, we can find a potential for it, and it's normalized to have integral zero. Okay, but informally, it means that empirical measures of zeros are highly concentrated, exponentially concentrated, in shrinking balls around this equilibrium measure. So here is the precise formula. When I write down a ball, this is the ball in the Wasserstein metric, which is here's the definition of the Wasserstein metric. It's a distance between probability measures, and it's the supremum over Lipschitz functions with Lipschitz constant less than or equal to 1 of the difference of the integral of f against the two measures. So that defines a metric on the space of measures. So I can talk about a ball in the space of measures. And what we do is we take 1 over n squared log of the probability. And notice that here on one side we have, this is the closure of the ball, this is the interior of the ball on the different sides. But in large deviations, you take the limit from what, you don't know that it has a limit, but if you take the limit of 1 over n squared log of the probability, it's greater than or equal to minus the infimum over this open set. And if you take the limit sup of 1 over n squared log of a probability, then it's less than or equal to minus the infimum over the closure. These are Vardon's axioms for a large deviations principle. in general, these could be taken as a definition. This is the definition of what it means to have a large deviations principle. And this is, by definition, the speed, and this is the rate function. So before, I just said that 1 over n squared log should just tend to this number. What? I know that shouldn't be here. A little typo here. I think there are going to be a couple more talks on large deviations today, and everybody will be using, I assume, the same definition. That's Vardhan's axiomatization of what it means to have a large deviations principle. Right? There's a speed and a rate functional, and 1 over n squared log of the probabilities have this kind of upper and lower bounds. So it's the same thing on both sides, except there's a topological difference. So I think I mentioned already this before, that results like this were proved for empirical measures of eigenvalues for random matrices, which are, by the way, simpler, because that soup over k functional, there's nothing like that comes up in random matrices. It's usually just some integral over against the empirical measure of some simple function like x squared. So actually, random matrices are easier than these problems. This is, to my knowledge, the first result on large deviations principle for zeros of random functions of any kind. Now, what was known previously? Well, quite a long time ago, Shiffman and I proved that this is a random measure. The empirical distribution of zeros of a random section is a random measure. So we took its average value with for each n, and we showed that it tends to the we just showed that it tends to the curvature 1-1 form of the line bundle. That was in the case of positive curvature. So we first proved that. Then later we looked in plane domains, just one-dimensional case, and we proved a result like this. When d nu was an analytic measure on a domain or its boundary and h was 0, Bloom proved this and related results when nu was merely a Bernstein-Markov measure but for and higher dimensional results. Berman proved results of this kind and related kinds when we have a smooth metric and a Bernstein-Markov measure, a general Kähler manifold. But these results, unless I'm missing something, are all about expected values or almost short convergence of sequences. In all correlation functions, in all those cases, we're integrating out all the variables. So I think this is the first one that takes all of the variables in configuration space. So let's give a heuristic proof of it. The proof is is somewhat technical, but many of the techniques are taken from the prior results on random matrices, and mainly have to do with the singularity of the logarithm of the Green's function. But anyway, it's not that hard to see what's going on. So what you're doing is we're taking the density of the joint probability current with respect to Lebesgue measures. Remember that we have these special section of the line bundle over configuration space, product Z minus zeta j. So we write that down, the joint probability current, in terms of this choice, and it's just Lebesgue measure on CP1 minus infinity. Take that that configuration space. So then we just take 1 over minus 1 over n squared log of the joint probability current, and I call this with an n. And it's easy to work it out. The Vandermond in the numerator, what we do is we rewrite this expression just in terms of the empirical measure of zeros. In fact, that's just absolutely obvious. This is the product of zeta j minus zeta k norm squared. So if we take 1 over n squared times its logarithm, we exactly just get this integral over here. I punctured out the diagonal here because these are measures of infinite energy. I have to puncture it out, but it also just doesn't appear because in the Vandermonde, you puncture out the diagonals too. Okay, so if you just take 1 over n squared log of this, you get this. So this is, it's obvious, but you take 1 over n squared times the logarithm of I not equal to j of zeta I minus zeta j squared, and we just write the logarithm as just the sum of the logs of zeta I minus zeta j squared, and this is by definition n squared times the integral of log of z minus w against the two empirical measures. It's just that. So it's sort of a if all of these are manifestly given to you as functions of the zeta j, it's just not very difficult to rewrite them in terms of the empirical measure of zeros, which is the sum of delta functions at the zeta j. You just have to write out the logarithms of these as integrals against these functions. So the denominator was given this way, and we can just also rewrite it this way. Because this product of z minus zeta j is the exponential of n times the logarithm of z minus w against this, or if we're a little bit cleverer, we rewrite it in terms of the Green's function. But once something is manifestly given to you this way, it's not hard to just rewrite it in terms as an integral against the empirical measure of zeros. Okay? Now, this term is going to stay here. This is sometimes called the entropy term or energy term. This one doesn't develop n, except that it only was restricted to these measures, these empirical measures which depend on n. Otherwise, it's already fine. This over here depends on n, and we have to take the large n limit. So we notice that what we have here is just the potential. We have the Green's potential, and we have e to the n times the Green's potential. And then we're sort of basically dividing by n over here. So it's basically just taking the logarithm of the ln norm of e to the Green's potential. That speed put this n up here. And so this just looks like the nth power of the Green's potential. Right, and then we're just taking its ln norm with respect to the Bernstein-Markov measure nu. And as n tends to infinity, the ln norm tends to the sup norm with respect to the measure nu. And so that tells us that the large n limit of that second term over here, the one which was coming from the L2 norm of the section, that this complicated denominator is producing for us a second term in the rate functional, which is the supremum over the support of nu of the potential. So this very natural object in the Fubini-Studi volume form is very different from what happens in random matrices, but you can see how it produces the sup norm over here. The sup functional. So as I mentioned over here, this sup functional turns out to be very, very useful to have. All these little details, the minus 1/2 and the sup functional, exactly conspire so that the minimizer of this is the equilibrium measure on K. This sup functional is going to sort of effectively constrain your measures to be supported on K. Now that's as much as I want to say about the genus zero case. I want to make a few remarks about How would you extend this? We would like to do this in principle on any Kähler manifold. So what happens? We're already in trouble from this point of view when we try to do it in higher genus, but it's very simple and pleasant. So in higher genus, what was the main step? The main step was finding an explicit formula for the joint probability current to zeros. As soon as we could do that, we just take one of Wren squared logarithm, and by very, very simple technique, we just find the rate functional out of that. At this stage, I don't know how to find the rate functional without writing down first the joint probability current to zeros. Looking backwards, the rate functional was just an energy of a measure plus a soup. I don't need to know the joint probability of current or the configuration space to write down that functional. But at this point, I do not know how to derive it, except that way. So I have to look at configuration spaces of Riemann surfaces of higher genus. And I have to look at the map from coefficients to zeros in higher genus. Now, in higher genus, we don't just have one line bundle of a given degree. We have a Picard variety. It's a complex torus of dimension equal to the genus. So if you wanted to say which configurations of zeros are most probable, well, zeros of what? Of a section of one fixed line bundle? That's not going to be a good question, because the zeros for one fixed line bundle is a fiber of the Abel-Jacobi map. You'll get an extremely singular joint probability current of zeros. So what we're going to do is, that's because the space of sections has a smaller dimension than the number of zeros. The map from coefficients to zeros is singular. It will have a singular image. So, as I said, the configurations of zeros of a fixed line bundle lie on a fiber of the Abel-Jacobi map from the configuration space to the Picard variety. The inverse image of a line bundle here is the zeros of the sections of that line bundle. So something very, very singular is going to happen here. But if there's an obvious way to deal with it, but then you're going to take you out of the family of Gaussian measures right away. Namely, you should look at all the line bundles of a fixed degree. The line bundles of a fixed degree form a projective bundle over the Picard variety. The fiber over a given line bundle is the projective space of sections of that line bundle. So there's a natural measure on this total space over here. Namely, we put just some Lebesgue measure or some other well-chosen measure. There's in fact a natural choice that I don't want to go into. But we put a measure and pick a line bundle at random from the Picard variety. You would think that the most natural measure would be Lebesgue measure. We would just pick it on the torus. We would just pick a line bundle at random from here, and then we're on a given fiber, which is a projective space, and then we pick a section at random using the Fubini-Studi measure on this projective space. Okay, that's a natural way of choosing a section at random. What's a random section? Well, first I have to choose the line bundle of which it is a section at random, and then I choose a random section from that space of sections. Now, the key step in genus zero was to write down the van der Mann determinant and the L2 norm. Now, it was a question, I would have thought this would be in the literature, but after searching for it, I couldn't find it. What is the natural generalization of the van der Mann determinant to higher genus? What's the natural generalization of the Newton formula? Product of Z minus zeta j is elementary symmetric functions of zeta times z to the j. Well, you have to answer those questions in order to be able to find the joint probability current of zeros. Now, z minus zeta j has a natural generalization to Riemann surfaces of higher genus. It's the Klein-Fay prime form. That's E of ZW. One way of thinking about what this E of ZW is is that for any point on the Riemann surface, you have a unique line bundle of degree one, which has a one-dimensional space of sections, all of which vanish at that point, called the point line bundle. And that has a section which corresponds to the function 1 under the usual correspondence between meromorphic functions and sections. So this form here is the value of the canonical section of the line bundle. The prime form, E of ZW, is the value of the canonical section for the point line bundle at P at the point W. Maybe that's the easiest way of explaining what it is. So let's look at this formula. Before, when the genus was 0, we did not have this factor, J equals 1 up to G. This is what replaces the Vandermonde, the product, the Vandermonde squared formula, natural replacement for it. This is something new. We're given this configuration of zeta, zeta 1 through zeta n, and we map it into, we have to choose certain base points for the Picard varieties. They're homogeneous spaces, but they're not groups. So after making those choices as a natural map from the zetas down to the Jacobian variety, and these PJs are the images of the zetas under the Abel-Jacobi map. So that's a kind of complicated factor that arises. Then in the denominator, we have the Bergman kernel for our inner product. And we have its determinant, which is an object that Berman and Bookson were also studying. It comes up naturally here. And then here's the L2 norm. That's like the L2 norm part in the denominator. Well, I had a... I think... Right. Right. Yeah. This one, this factor here is very similar to this factor. I think the difference is that it has to do with whether you write K not equal to J or K less than J. This is actually like the squaring the E, and this actually cancels out one square, and it additionally puts in that normalization factor. And here we have a normalization constant. Okay, so I'm a little ahead of time, which means I probably went too fast. But anyway, the final comments are the following. The key step in this was to find an exact formula for the joint probability current in terms of coordinates on configuration space. This is also the Achilles heel of this procedure, because we can't seem to generalize this to higher dimensions if we have that approach. To my knowledge, there is no good configuration space for zeros of one or several sections in higher dimensions, except to use the original projective space of sections. We don't have any useful zeros coordinates in higher dimensions. When we took the limit, we obtained a rate functional, and the rate functional made perfect sense in all dimensions, although I don't suspect that it's not going to be exactly the same thing. But there's an energy term and a soup term, which comes from the L2 norm. If you look at these L2 norms, they're always going to be there. So that term will probably always be the same. And then we should, in all dimensions, we should have some energy term coming from this. So the functional makes perfect sense in all dimensions, but the proof doesn't. And the second, I guess, last remark, although I didn't really go over much of the proof, was the role of this particular soup functional. It's a nice functional to study if one's learning about subharmonic functions, because it requires almost every theorem in the textbooks about subharmonic functions to prove that this thing is upper semi-continuous and that it's lower semi-continuous as well under a certain assumption on K, which is that the Green's function should be L1 with respect to some measure supported on K. So I guess I'll stop here. Yeah. No. No, I mean, the zetas. I have to remember this for a second. We have one. See, there's actually, you get an inner product on the space of sections. They all differ by flat line bundles. So one Hermitian inner product and one nu define you inner products, no matter what it is. So I didn't put it in explicitly here what the dependence was. But it's really just one metric and one measure define you an orthogonal projection for every one of these line bundles. So it was that. And it's sort of implicit in the zetas which space you're talking about, right? So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you.